Accession number 7366, rule number 2.
Colonel Wilde, reel 2. Colonel, what were your first impressions of the Sudan once you arrived there?
Well, quite honestly, there didn't appear to be anything. There were no villages, no towns. We were just set down and by the side of a railway line and just scrub and wilderness, really. It was really like the back of beyond. I remember, for example, our first night when the G2 had a particular horror of snakes. And so we said, don't worry, and escorted him to his bed and shined our torches up the tree just to reassure him. And there was an enormous great snake coiled above his bed. And so he's never looked back, really. We went off a few yards to our own bedding rails just under the tree and washed in our little round basins called chalumpches, climbed into our things and went to bed. And I remember a very, very dark night, you couldn't see a thing, and we absolutely froze with horror to hear the stealthy feet of some heavy animal and the noise of lapping the water out of our basins. And I must say, we were pretty frightened. We didn't sleep very much. And we explored the pud marks the next morning, but I think that it was probably only cattle.
Did you meet any of the native population while you were at Deradeb?
There didn't seem to be anybody there, speaking from memory. We waited there until our transport caught up with us. And then we set a compass course, because there were no roads whatsoever, and we just headed off across the scrubland of the Sudan, heading towards Kassala. And on the way, yes indeed, we met a lot of the local Sudanese, all of whom seemed to be on ponies or asses, carrying spears, and they had one look at us, and they leapt screaming off their steeds and ran into the bush. And we couldn't understand this until we discovered, really, that none of them had ever seen a motor vehicle in their lives before. And so we went on, and we arrived on the outskirts of Kassala, and that was held as a very much as a key point by the Italians, and we climbed up to a vantage point to carry out a reconnaissance for the attack on it, and we were briefed by Colonel Massavi, who then commanded a mixed force of British and Sudanese troops called Gazelle Force, and he was later destined, in fact, to command the 4th Indian Division. And so the attack on Kassala was all planned, but before it went in, reconnaissance showed the Italians, in fact, had pulled out before the attack went in.
Did you have a look at the Italian positions after they'd pulled out?
No, I don't think we did. Kassala itself was a sort of mountain, if you like, or very high hill, and we climbed up that to look at the positions, but I don't think I can give you much detail about the actual positions themselves. They would have been on the tops of the hills, which is where they always were. And as the ground all round there was solid rock, it's more likely it would be in sangers of rocks rather than slip trenches.
Presumably the fact they were rock would make artillery bombardment particularly effective with secondary missiles.
Yes, of course the splintering would be absolutely lethal on that hard ground, and the troops would not be able to dig in very much.
You mentioned that the Italians pulled out of Kassala without a fight. Did you know anything about their intentions at that time?
No, I don't think we did at that time. Being wise after the event, I think those battles in the desert at Sidi Barani, where they lost so many men, had a profound effect upon the attitude of the command of the Italians in Eritrea. They had every opportunity to push right forward and get to Khartoum and sever the communications up the Nile, and they could have done it with the greatest of ease. But I think that those earlier reverses which they had in the desert affected their outlook, and I think that their psychological approach, if we can put it that way, was instead of going forward, was to withdraw as slowly as possible back to Kerin, which was, in their view, an impregnable fortress behind which they could shelter forever.
So they were really on the defensive from the very beginning.
I think that by the time we arrived in Kassala, it is true to say that they were on the defensive.
What were your first impressions of Eritrea when you resumed the advance?
Well, rather surprising, really, because in the Sudan one had seen, or we had seen, very little evidence of colonization. And as soon as we crossed the border into Eritrea, we found that the physical manifestations of Italian colonization made themselves very apparent in metal roads, not many of them admittedly, just one, but a metal road and properly constructed houses with flyproof screening and so on. The terrain as a whole, of course, was valleys dominated on each side by high, rugged, rocky hills. And, of course, it was jolly hot.
Did you encounter any Italian civilians, any settlers, while you were moving
through? No, these houses, what I'm talking about, were all empty. And I think that, as far as I can remember, we met really extremely few civilians indeed. And I think that they all retreated towards Asmara, back ahead of the withdrawing Italian troops.
How did the Italians resist the advance into Eritrea?
Largely through a series of very stoutly held rearguard actions. As they pulled back, they would establish themselves on either side of the approach on the high hills, where they were able to establish really very strong positions. And it was ended by a really determined infantry and gunner attacks that eventually would dislodge them or go round them. And when they felt that they were being encircled, then they pulled back to the next defensive position.
When they did this sort of thing, did they generally manage to get away with it and slip back to the next position, or did you usually manage to encircle them and capture them?
In the smaller actions, they very largely got away. But later on, when it came, for example, to a place called Ergodet, which was a very, very strongly held position indeed, with high mountains, and this took a tremendous series of attacks by the division in order to dislodge them, and eventually we found a way round behind them. And this did entail the capture of really quite a significant number of prisoners and equipment and booty of all sorts.
In smaller scale actions, how long would it normally take to actually force or encircle or threaten a position? How long would an action go on?
Well, a very small one, I suppose it could be done in the course of a day, depending on what enemy strength he had. But the more strongly held positions would be an attack lasting many days, with the deployment of the artillery, a lot of fire plans, and a really determined attack by day or by night. And it went on for several days.
When you say a really small one, one that could be dealt with in a day, what size would the enemy force be for that sort of action?
Well, I suppose he could have left a company or possibly a battalion supported by guns.
Did you have an opportunity to observe their tactics, the enemy tactics?
Well, their tactics really were to hold the high ground. They didn't bother too much about the valleys, but they defended these high mountains which dominated the plains completely, and nowhere could our troops go on through the valleys with the enemy still on the dominating hills. So the series of actions that I'm trying to indicate really were they would be established on the hills, we went as far as we could, deployed set-piece attacks, infantry climbing these ruddy great mountains and eventually dislodging them, and the enemy then fell back on their own transport back in the valleys, and those that could escaped and went back to the next defensive position, leaving hopefully quite a lot of prisoners behind.
Did the positions have to be stormed with bayonet charges?
Some of them indeed, yes. Indeed, yes.
What sort of troops were you up against? Were they Europeans in the main, or were they locally recruited?
It was a very, very different type of enemy to what we had previously met in the Western Desert. The cream of the Italian troops, the Bersaglieri, the Guards, and Alpini, it was the pick of the Italian army was in East Africa, and the Eritrean troops were very, very good. It was an incredible setup, really, because later, we haven't got to Karen yet, but there you would find an incredibly staunch resistance, nobody giving way, dying where they stood, and yet the next morning you might have a half a company just coming over and surrendering. It was an incredible mixture. But basically they were very good defenders and very good troops indeed, fought superbly.
What about their artillery? Was it well coordinated with their infantry action?
To a limited extent, yes. They didn't appear to have very many heavy guns. They had a great many of 65 millimetres, and they were well used. In Eritrea as a whole, yes, they were quite well used, but not in any great concentrations. At Keren, which perhaps you're coming on to later, I could tell you a bit more about them there.
During these rearguard actions, did they make great use of artillery to support their...
Oh, indeed. Indeed, yes.
Did they use mainly indirect fire or direct fire?
Indirect fire, but they had the great advantage, of course, that their observation posts were up on the hills where they could see us, and their guns were behind the hills and we couldn't see them.
Could you do anything about their artillery? Could you do any counter-battery work?
Not very much until you could see. Now, our observation, our OP parties, used to go, of course, with the leading infantry. And so when the leading infantry got to the tops of the hills and captured them, then you could look down and see what you were shooting at. But it was difficult until you had observation. We had a small counter-battery organization which joined us later on at Keren, where we did our best from our point of view on indirect counter-battery work as far as we were able. But we were dogged throughout this whole campaign from an artillery point of view in the difficulty of seeing until our observation posts had got with the infantry on top of these hills.
I presume you were able to give the infantry some support in making their attacks.
Indeed. I think that if you ask the infantry, we would find in this, as in any other campaign, the gunners really did play a very predominant role indeed. Naturally, although we couldn't see, as I've mentioned, back into their gun and concentration areas, one naturally supported the infantry all the way by far onto the enemy held positions on the high ground. And I think it would be true to say without artillery support, the infantry wouldn't have got anywhere.
Was this usually direct fire or indirect?
Indirect.
What sort of range would you normally fire at?
Well, the maximum range of our weapons was about 11,000 yards. It depended very much, but perhaps you were engaging probably at about 6,000, 7,000 yards, at a guess. That sort of thing.
And you had observers forward with the infantry?
Indeed, yes.
Did the enemy ever attempt to bombard your own gun positions?
Yes. Yes, certainly. Because our guns were basically, of course, for obvious reasons, in the valleys, whereas our infantry, and indeed theirs, were on the high ground. And this perhaps led to a peculiar performance. The only instance, I think, in World War II of a cavalry charge against the guns. Out of a dust cloud, it was really rather like a film set, really, galloped a group of Eritrean cavalry led by an Italian major in a lovely white hat. He was picked off by the battery Tiffy, using a recently arrived boy's anti-tank rifle. The guns depressed their muzzles maximum down, bounced the shells on the ground about 100 yards in front of the guns, hoping that they would detonate and act rather like shrapnel. But it was really quite a performance.
What was the result of this cavalry attack?
They lost a lot of chaps. They were armed with little red hand grenades, one or two head swords, but they came on and there was quite a sort of free-for-all, and I seem to remember they galloped on through and they lost a lot, and the others eventually found their way back. But I think it was quite a surprise to them and quite a surprise to us.
So they did actually press home their attack?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
And the officer was killed, was he?
Yes, he was.
Did you capture any of the cavalry?
I really can't remember. Isn't that extraordinary? But one's memory of it happening, and a lot were left sort of dead as a result of it, I suppose we did.
Did you suffer any casualties?
Not very many. Not really very many at all.
How did your men actually fight back once the Italians were in amongst you?
I think with almost everything they had. Pick helves and anything to hand.
It's hand-to-hand combat with improvised weapons.
With improvised weapons, yes.
Now, I think that took place at a Gordat.
That took place probably this side of Air Gordat, I think. Before, Air Gordat itself was a very strongly held position indeed, with very high mountains. And this meant the deployment of the whole division and attacks lasting a long time until eventually, by brilliant work by the infantry scaling these high mountains, the heights were eventually taken and we managed to get round the back and the enemy started pulling out when they reckoned that they'd been encircled. But it was a big battle. We caught quite a lot of prisoners out of that. and quite a lot of booty. Speaking personally, I remember coming across boxes and boxes full of the Italian pay, stuffed with high denomination lira notes. And we thought our fortunes were made, but then we reckoned sadly they would be worthless. I've always rather wondered since, actually. Also, masses of cases of Asti Spumante. Now, they were nearly red hot, and it really was utterly loathsome. So, although drink was almost entirely unavailable, that too was discarded.
Was the artillery heavily involved in this fighting at Agordat?
Oh, yes, indeed. Very much so. I mean, a set-piece attack like that, I mean, the whole divisional artillery would be deployed, and complicated and detailed fire plans worked out for the support of the infantry in their attacks. Oh, very much so.
When you were fighting your way forward in Eritrea, going through the various Italian blocking positions and so on, when the guns were actually put into action, did you dig pits for them on every occasion?
Out there, not very much, because of two reasons. One, it was a moving war for the most part, and there wasn't time. And secondly, the terrain was such that you really couldn't dig in much into the rock. Now, in the desert, that was different. In the desert, you certainly dug in. But out there, not very much at that stage in the moving campaign. When we got to Keren, yes, we had to do what we could.
So it's really a case of getting into a good position for firing and then getting on with it.
That's right.
Did you build sangars for the guns at all?
No, I don't think we probably did. Not in moving warfare, you haven't got time. Once the thing bogs down, then you take every possible precaution you can by digging in or sandbags or whatever it is to protect your gun position.
Did the Italian artillery ever fire directly at you? Did you get counter-battery fire incoming on you at all?
Yes. The word direct, of course, is a technical term in artillery circles. Direct means over open sights. And the answer to that is no. Did they fire at the guns? The answer is yes.
Did they have any success in trying to knock you out?
In all this terrain, particularly at Keren, their observation posts could look down on our gun positions in the valleys, and say they were, from a counter-battery point of view, rather better placed than we were. But their guns had not got a long range, and I don't think we suffered very much, not many casualties from counter-battery.
And presumably they only had light shells as well.
Yes, that's so.
While you were involved in this advance, did you have any support from the Royal Air Force?
The Royal Air Force was very stretched throughout the Middle East Command at this stage, and during the run-up to Keren, we really had none at all. In fact, I remember that our bomber support, if one could call it that, was one old Vickers Valencia troop carrier, top speed 90 miles an hour, and the crew lobbing hand grenades out of the open door, and that was it. The Italian Air Force was quite active and used to come over and strafe quite a lot.
By strafe, do you mean machine gun attacks?
Machine gun and bombing, yes.
Did you have any means to hold them off?
No, at that stage, if I remember, and I think I remember correctly, we didn't have any anti-aircraft regiment at all at that stage.
Did they inflict a lot of damage upon the division?
To some extent. I remember one battalion was caught in the open and they lost quite a lot of casualties from strafing. But inevitably, in any attack like that, there are bound to be a certain amount of casualties, but it wasn't, shall we say, a dominating factor in the campaign.
How did the administration and supply services operate on the march through Eritrea?
Well, as you can imagine, we had a very, very long line of communication. The roads were very bad and very few, and the shortage of transport was severe. So that the further we moved into Eritrea, so did the administrative headache become greater. And as a staff captain responsible for the administration of the divisional artillery, one had increasing difficulties in trying to provide the ammunition, stores, petrol, food, water, and all the stores that were needed by the fighting troops.
Did you ever run seriously short of ammunition?
We never had as much as one could have wanted or could have used, is the quick answer to that. But we never, ever ran completely short.
Did the knowledge that you were having difficulty in resupplying ammunition have an impact upon plans for fire support?
No, because we always managed to do everything that was required of us. And speaking personally, once it was the other way around, one was told that the fire planned entailed so many rounds of ammunition, and somehow one had to make jolly certain it was there.
And you were always able to scrape it together somehow?
Somehow, yes.
What about food and water and other stores? Were you ever seriously short of those?
They were all in short supply. Food, we were on, you know, minimum rations. Water, when we got up to Kerin, for example, there was only one source of local supply, and that we had to share with our local residents, who were blue-bottomed baboons. I remember talking about food. I remember so well a heavy parcel suddenly arriving out of the blue, addressed to me, and this turned out to be a whole Stilton cheese in an earthenware jar, and in spite of the intense heat, it was in perfect condition. And I think this speaks worlds, not only for Fortnum & Mason, from whom it was sent by an aunt of mine at the start of the war, but also to the administrative tail, who somewhere in the Middle East had found out where I was.
And managed to get it.